So welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site, HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Now, as summer draws to a close, it's important to discuss with parents and their children some tips for making the return to school more smoothly as possible, especially about lung health. Now, for that reason, we are joined today by two of the American Lung Association's national medical spokespersons, Dr. Christy Sadriamelli, who is a pediatric pulmonologist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, where she takes care of pediatric patients of all ages with a variety of pulmonary conditions, and Dr. Juanita Mora, who is a physician and leader in the field of allergy and immunology, practicing in Chicago. So during the next 20 to 30 minutes, I'd like to hear your views on at least three issues that the American Lung Association feels are important for respiratory health, especially as we plan on getting our children back into the school year. These include asthma control and the phenomenon sometimes called peak week, the prevalence and hazards of vaping and e-cigarettes in the school-age population, and also the importance of up-to-date vaccine schedules, especially related to respiratory pathogens. So let's start out with this term peak week. Please, for our listeners, tell us what that means with regard to the patients and their asthma, and what are some important messages for parents and children about trying to maintain stability in their asthma control during this time of the year?
Well, first of all, I have to say that as an allergist and immunologist, I love vaccine season for so many reasons. One is getting kids asthma action plans. The time they come to me and they say, okay, Dr. Mora, get me an updated asthma action plan. It's time to, one, review medications. It's two, make sure that their inhalers are up to date and they're not expired. Three, that they're using them correctly. Four, that if they need a spacer, they're using a spacer as well too. So, and then also reminding them and figuring out what the triggers, any triggers for their asthma. Has something thrown it out of control? A new little cat at home, a new little dog at home, the seasonal allergies, definitely ragweed and weeds. The pollen season in the spring has been really hard hit, and a lot of asthma has been out of control. So it allows me to have these conversations. And then last but not least, I also have to say, this is my time to also remind them, you're going to have to come back in the fall for a flu shot. Let's update your actual vaccinations as well, too. If you're not up to date, make sure you get your physical in with your pediatrician. All your vaccinations are up to date. And your COVID-19 vaccine, which will hopefully be out this early fall. So that way we get everyone protected and updated. And these are the conversations. Now, you also asked about peak week. Do you want to take it, Chrissy?
Yeah, sure. So when we think about asthma peak week in the fall around the back to school season, you know, it refers to a big uptick in asthma exacerbations. When we say asthma exacerbations, we mean, you know, a period of flare up. It's typically a period often of at least a few days, maybe longer, where people are experiencing more difficulty with their asthma. So coughing, wheezing, chest tightness, shortness of breath. They need their rescue inhaler more often. And we do often see this, you know, very early in the back to school period. And one of the big drivers of this is, you know, kids are getting back together in a close setting, and there are viruses that get spread around. We see this every year. And parents often tell me, oh, they do great in summer, then they go back to school and they get sick. I would say, you know, in addition to that, Dr. Mora has already nicely outlined that many of our allergens are seasonal. So for some patients, depending what they're allergic to, you know, certain pollens, for example, I think I'm a pulmonologist, not an allergist, but I think of things like ragweed happening in that very late summer, early fall period. That can coincide with this reentry to school, getting a virus. And if someone's having multiple triggers at once, meaning the virus is flaring the asthma and the allergies are affecting that person, it can just be a recipe for an asthma episode. And the best thing to do to be prepared for that, you know, some of the viruses in schools, that's just a reality. It's just something that happens. And so I think it's very important that we do what we can to make sure people are on a good preventative asthma regimen. Sometimes people are prescribed asthma controller medications, preventative medications, and they may or may not be taking them as often during the summer. But it's important to either make sure you're taking them as prescribed or touch base with your physician or your healthcare provider to make sure you're on the right plan as you go into that situation. Because really, our goal is for someone to be on a good asthma plan so that when you ideally you get a cold or you encounter your allergen and it's not leading into a spiraling effect of severe asthma flare-ups. So, you know, we can preempt some of this and just remember that that's a vulnerable time of year. It's a good time to go into it proactively, being on the right regimen and being on top of the meds.
Right. I want to go back to Dr. Moore mentioned the action plan. I'm curious as to how much you interact with school nurses, for example, who I suspect should have a copy of that asthma action plan for many of their students. Is that something you run into as a physician, or is that mainly the parents that deal with that?
Well, usually what we do is we give the parent an asthma action plan, and they also submit it to the school along with an albuterol inhaler so that the kids have it. And a lot of the times, especially for kids who have severe asthma or maybe are having a little more trouble, the nurse will actually call the office and say, "Hey, Dr. Moore, I'm seeing this patient, and they're having a little more trouble with their breathing. And so I wanted to touch base and see if the action plan that you put through is still valid, or do you want me to make any changes?" Which I love the communication at that point as well, too, because I think it shows that she cares, that we're all touching points to really care for this child. And I think it's important to have that open communication with the parents, with the schools as well, too. And I think, you know, it's part of also being involved with the community, which I think is important as well, too, when talking to the Chicago public school system, like here in Chicago, which I am, or anywhere that you are as well.
And do you find if there's, I think some rules are different about school districts and localities as far as access to rescue inhalers, as far as the patients being able to actually have them, or they have to go through their school nurses. Do you see much difference there?
What I usually have is to write a note so that the student can self-care. So if the student doesn't have a note that they can self-carry and self-administer, then the nurse has to administer the actual medication. But if they're old enough and they know their triggers, then I usually allow them to carry and I allow them to actually administer their own medication.
Right.
Yeah, I can speak to that too. You know, ideally, everybody with asthma and certainly any patient I'm meeting or taking care of, they do need their own. And this is in Maryland and it's pretty common across the country. They need an official form that's filled out, that's standardized, explaining their rescue medication, which is usually albuterol in the school setting. And they also need an asthma action plan for the schools to be able to give albuterol. So not only do they need paperwork, but the patient must bring the medication and usually a spacer of their own and leave that for the school. And there's rules about how it's done. It needs to be done every year at the beginning of the year. Need to make sure the medication's not expired and that the paperwork's up to date. And that's very important on the individual level. Dr. Moore and I are both practicing in states, Illinois and Maryland, that have laws that also allow an additional safety mechanism, which we call stock albuterol. And what that means is, and in Maryland, this just happened. So our law went into effect a couple weeks ago on July 1st. So it hasn't really been put into practice yet, but in Illinois it's been there for longer. But basically it's an additional safety mechanism where we're asking schools to have a mechanism to have albuterol on hand for respiratory emergency. That's meant to fill the gap for kids who aren't able to turn in their medication, or maybe they don't realize they have asthma and they have their first bad episode at school. It's not meant to replace So for example, here in Maryland, now that we have this law, I'm not changing what I do. You know, we don't say, oh, the school has it, you're good. Because everybody's asthma plan is individualized and we want to make sure that we do the best we can. So when we talk about working with schools, I've worked with nurses and schools one-on-one, like Dr. Mora was talking about, and also on a larger level in terms of advocacy and policy making. And we'd really like to see, me personally and a lot of my colleagues, would like to see those kind of laws and policies occur in all 50 states. I think we're up to about 20 now, but all 50 states have stock epinephrine for food allergies. So we're just trying to bring up stock albuterol to match that. So that's also related, but doesn't replace, you know, individual patient level care documents we do.
And that's certainly an advocacy aspect of what the American Lung Association tries to do across the country as well.
Yeah, they do a lot in Maryland, so much.
One other question about these inhalers. Do you see things changing with recently the advent of, you know, the combined steroid and quick-acting or long-acting bronchodilators being used on as-needed basis? Do you see that changing what you do with your school-age children at this point?
I can speak to that. I bet Dr. Morrill will speak to that too. I just actually did an asthma in service with one of our schools that has a clinic within the school last week. And we were just talking about this. So smart therapy, the use of, you know, an inhaled steroid with formoterol combined as both a maintenance and a rescue inhaler, or in some older patients, just as a rescue. That's a great plan. It's within the guidelines for many patients. And depending on asthma severity and age, it may be the preferred plan if we're looking at both, you know, NIH US guidelines and also international, which we call GINA guidelines. However, I'll say what I've been doing. I think for schools, for a number of reasons, which range from practicalities with insurance companies covering multiple drugs, in younger kids, the fact that the maximum puffs in a 24-hour period is 8, which might be a little tricky to keep track of between home and school. For many of my patients on smart therapy, I actually have them just using albuterol at school because it's meant to keep them safe in an emergency, and it's more straightforward. We're more easily able to ensure their access to that, you know, meaning insurance will cover it. Because we might be asking an insurance company to give 3 inhalers in 1 month, because some people need 2 per month already, which we have trouble getting covered, and then a 3rd one for school. And also knowing that the patient can be kept safe. But at the same time, there are patients who may need their smart therapy in school. So I'm kind of trying to do both. Like in many cases, albuterol for school is appropriate, but in patients where we either want them to do smart therapy at schools, or maybe they're not my patient and that's what their doctor has recommended for school, we also want to make sure those schools understand that and are able to use that. We know that is, you know, in some cases the superior way to manage asthma long term. But what I'm envisioning is, even for my patients on that, it's really important when they're getting into a flare up and when they're sick. And I'm often envisioning a day that they're probably home from school and needing more frequent treatments. So I've been doing a little bit of a mix, but I don't know what Dr. Moore has found to work.
I love it. No, I've actually been doing a similar approach, because you're right. It's going to take time to transition. And we're teaching the nurses as well to compare the combined actual inhaler and why are we using it this way? So we're bringing them up to guidelines. So where I've been using it in schools is more in the patients that have more complicated asthma, where I've noticed albuterol is definitely not enough. They've had asthma exacerbations in school. Then I will actually explain to the nurse, touch base, and tell them this is exactly what I want. No, it wasn't miswritten. It actually is the new guidelines, and this is how I want it. I want us to treat him and work together for this child. Now, for the red conventional, keep them on albuterol, but I think it'll take time to transition as we have to teach each school system as well to about the guidelines.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Recent data from the CDC shows that in 2023, e-cigarettes were the most used tobacco product among middle and high school students in the United States. This means that during 2023, 2.1 million, or 7.7% of students, currently used e-cigarettes. This includes about 4.6% of middle school students and 10% of high school students. And among students who had ever used e-cigarettes, close to 50% reported current e-cigarette use among students who currently use e-cigarette use, 25% use an e-cigarette every day. Now, based on what you see in your practices, are you surprised by these numbers, or do you find that there is continued presence of misinformation around the health risks of vaping among the students, and for that matter, among their parents as well? And how do you address this in your practices?
I think it's an epidemic, and I definitely believe that as physicians, every single day we're fighting this misinformation. At the American Lung Association, I cannot tell you how many parents I say, and they give them the website on the TikTok, because it's so important for them to talk to their kids about vaping before they even get to seventh and eighth grade, because they're starting younger and younger. They found stocks of alcohol, e-cigarettes in bathrooms in middle schools and high schools. So if we don't start talking to the kids early on, then they won't know what the dangers are. So really is talking to the parents, talking to the kids in here. And actually some parents have brought the kids into clinic here who are vaping and said, Dr. Mora, their asthma has been off. They started vaping. I need you to talk to them. And so it's really having that conversation. I had one teenager who actually was intubated with an asthma exacerbation secondary to when he started vaping. And so it really scared him. And now I tell that story to my other teenagers that I have here, and I tell them about these dangers. And I'm sure Dr. Sandramelli also has similar stories about the dangers of vaping.
Yeah, so vaping and talking about vaping and getting the word out to our youth is something that I'm really passionate about, and something that I really enjoyed partnering with the Lung Association with over the years, because I have seen it in my practice. I continue to see people vaping in my practice, and I see the pulmonary harms as well. And that's just the people who are young and doing it and are already exhibiting the symptoms of the harms. Some people may not realize they're harming their lungs until they're a bit older. So the bottom line is there's so much misinformation out there about vaping and e-cigarette use. We know that, unfortunately, use is very common among youth. And even though the rates have varied over the past few years, we've had some ups and downs, it is still way too high. And it's really a sad story, because we were really winning, you know, the battle against tobacco, big tobacco, with our youth. And then e-cigarettes just happened to come on the scene and, you know, appear to be creating a whole new generation of problems, literally and figuratively. So I think of it this way. They are harmful to the lungs, e-cigarettes. We know that flavors are a big driver and attractor for youth. Many of the products that youth are using are not approved. They have not undergone FDA review. You know, many of them are on the market illegally. In fact, the most popular things, which are flavored devices, most of them have not, you know, been given permission to be on the market. So that bothers me. I think it's really hard to, the cat's out of the bag, and it's hard to get it under control. And meanwhile, our youth that are using these products are getting addicted very quickly. So some of the harms I've seen in my practice in terms of pulmonary harms, I consider addiction to be a harm, you know, induced by using an e-cigarette. And many of the devices, these pod-based devices that are very popular with youth, often the flavored ones, they're extremely addictive. They have very high levels of nicotine. So that's one harm right there, because you're looking at the risk of a lifelong addiction. And also, you know, changing brain chemistry at a too young of an age when the brain is still vulnerable to that. I'm thinking of preteens and teens. And then, you know, we see both really acute harm. So similar to what Dr. Mora mentioned, you know, E-Valley is the e-cigarette or vaping associated lung injury. We obviously had a big rash of those happening in, I'm trying to remember my years. I think it was the fall of 2019, late summer of 2019. Well, even though we're not seeing it that high of a level, we're still seeing it. I've treated someone with E-Valley this summer who was previously healthy. And that patient got sick extremely quickly, extremely sick. And thank goodness is doing better now and has stopped using products. But I also see people either with or without a previous history of asthma who are either developing new or worsening symptoms that are asthma-like, and really tend to not get much better until they stop using the product. So I could go on about this. I've probably said too much already, but I
think this is great. And as you both know, you mentioned
it's important. And just helping our youth understand, you know, why they're harmful and that they're harmful. That's all stuff that I'm very focused on.
And I think you both mentioned the, you know, the vape talk for parents and, yes, and preschools, both of which can be accessed on the Lung Association website. So I think Dr. Moore touched on this a little bit earlier, but as we send our children back to school, routine vaccinations need to be talked about. What kind of topic do you bring up, and especially with the, again, the recent advent of more vaccines being administered, misinformation around vaccines, how do you begin the discussion both with the parents and with their children about vaccinations?
Well, one of the things we know is that we saw a decrease in immunization rates in children after the pandemic. And the reason is because through the pandemic, a lot of pediatricians' offices were closed for routine immunizations, so these kids weren't taken. So then we had a lag. And when they look at, on a national level, what the rate of vaccinations pre-pandemic was, which was about 96% for pediatrics, CDC, we dropped to 80% of immunization rate at post-pandemic, which means we started lagging in immunizations to actual diseases that were already eradicated, like the measles. We saw measles outbursts throughout the U.S. We also saw cases of whooping cough, which we hadn't seen for a long time either. And we also saw some polio cases, which we had not seen for years. So this prompts a conversation, as I see lots of families with multiple kids, different ages, and I tell them, have they set up their actual visit with the pediatrician? Are the kids up to date with vaccinations? Because this is so important. And if there's any doubt that the parents have, especially because there was a lot of misinformation around the COVID-19 vaccines, then parents then kind of got fearful, I think, a little about giving just routine vaccinations to their kids. So it's bringing this conversation back to the safety level where we're saying, okay, benefits outweigh the risks. Vaccines at the end of the day save lives. We've seen diseases completely eradicated. We want to keep them this way. So let's actually get you into your pediatrician, play catch up if there's there's actual shots that need administered. And of course, I also use this space to really, really talk about the flu vaccine and COVID-19 vaccine. So I'm getting mine, they're ordered. I get them at the end of August, and families are already scheduling for flu vaccines in the office. I had a mom who scheduled 3 kids and herself for flu vaccines at the beginning of September today. So it really prompts this conversation that we need to have with our patients.
Great.
Yeah, and I think things like flu vaccination, COVID vaccination, these annual vaccines, they're extra important for our patients with asthma. And, you know, we've known for a long time that getting your flu shot each year can reduce the risk of hospitalization. We actually recommend this for all people and for all kids. But if someone has asthma, they're even more at risk for a hospitalization from flu or COVID. Actually, flu, I mean, we've really seen it's really bad stuff over the years. So I try to share those experiences with families, and hopefully it helps. I have worked with some families who are scared to do these vaccinations, and then through working together and shared decision-making, they were able to do it. And for some of these families, it's become an annual tradition, and then they're able to break through that. So we continue to try to support families as best we can.
So one last topic I'd like you both to comment on is, you know, we hit things, the Lung Association's obviously very concerned about asthma stability, the vaping epidemic, vaccine accessibility. But there's things that clinicians can't do, even though you educate the parents and the children. We need to talk about the environment that these children go back to school in. We know that respiratory health can be impacted by the quality of the indoor air in schools. School environments vary a lot based on their resources in the school district, the age of the buildings, the location of the buildings. So have you had to, either through your practice or through parents, needed any opportunity to address this with parents or even talk to school district administrators regarding the needs of what a school has to do to keep the air quality at least acceptable on a much broader scale?
I think it's a great topic. Here in Chicago, I actually had a chance, because in Little Village, which is a predominantly Hispanic and in poor actual income level neighborhood, there was a plant demolition that occurred that did not have an unauthorized permission and caused horrible air quality. And kids and adults all had a lot of repercussions. I had a first time wheezer actually come into the office after the plant demolition, and he was playing outside for recess. So then I got to actually speak to the school and talk about the importance of closing the windows, especially as the air quality was so poor, making sure ventilation was good, HEPA filters were installed, and that we talked to every parent about the importance of if the children developed any coughing, any wheezing, any shortness of breath, that they were to talk to their pediatrician, that they were to seek emergency department help. And so it really brought about change because obviously these kids were in a harmful environment when it came to their air quality.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of air quality at school, I think about reducing risk of respiratory viruses. And that's all viruses, you know, the ones we've been really focused on the last few years, particularly COVID, maybe flu to some extent. But even, you know, kids with asthma, if they get the common cold, one of the many strains, rhinovirus, things like that, they could end up in the hospital. So, you know, kind of reducing the amount of viruses in the air is a good thing. I think a lot of this, I'm not an expert on, you know, building health, air, how it all works, but I know things are, it's really important to ensure that we have adequate filtration and ventilation. Here in Baltimore City, we pretty recently had schools without central air conditioning, and it gets quite hot here. So not only the heat, but also poor air quality that goes along with not having this kind of modernized, updated air system. I think hopefully it's been updated in all the schools now, but there were schools that were having to close during, you know, high heat days for not only comfort reasons, but even like lung health reasons. I do think about things like pests in the school when we have much older schools. You can have in a city, for example, you can have mice in the schools, asthma triggers, things like that. I will say I've started working with the schools more and more through my work on stock albuterol and recently thinking about smart therapy and other things. But I haven't yet had the opportunity to help work with a school or advise them on how to make the air quality better. But I would be happy to do so and maybe should think about, you know, how I can use my expertise to be helpful in the future.
Well, this has been a great discussion, and you both are great spokespersons for the American Lung Association. You hit all the topics that we're very concerned about, and you know the kind of things that we need to teach our patients and our parents, their parents, about. So before we close, any other issue that you want to bring up that maybe we didn't hit upon?
I think we covered the things. I will say, I know Dr. Warren and I are both really passionate about all of these topics.
Why I picked you.
Maybe that's why you picked us.
Yes, we are. And we love kids. We love to know. And kids health, et cetera. I honestly urge all parents who listen to this podcast to go to lung.org. There is a lot of information that's there. If you actually have any hesitancy on a flu vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine, there's a lot of information on the website, asthma. And then if your teenager's baby, please, please visit our website. Look at all the resources that we have to help, and let's start the big talk.
I agree with that. I have one more thing to close for me. You know, I often tell my parents, my patients, you know, the goal with treating asthma is to let someone have a normal life as possible. So when we're thinking about kids, whether that's a young elementary school kid or, you know, an older adolescent, young enough adult who's going off to college, I want my patient to be able to have the most normal life possible. So all the things we're talking about today, you know, avoiding e-cigarettes, using your asthma medications as prescribed, including preventative medications, staying on top of vaccination, all of this is toward that goal. You know, we want kids to be able to run, to play, to have a healthy, happy life as much as possible.
Great message. So thank you both again for taking the time today and also for your year-round volunteerism, for being a medical spokesperson for the American Lung Association. For our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding all these respiratory-related issues, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.